Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. So we are sitting here in Manhattan Beach, just outside of Los Angeles, with Alan Ehrenbaum, who at one point was the person I reported to for some work that I did in Connecticut. I just flew in from Connecticut to LA, and we're sitting down in Alan's offices in Manhattan Beach to talk about his career and what he does now. And thankfully, we are in sunny LA, which is very different than cloudy New England. So I'm happy to be here. Alan, good morning.
Welcome to LA, Jim.
Why don't you tell our listeners about your current work? You work in many state capitals. You oversee different lobbyists in those state capitals. We worked in Connecticut on an issue, I guess it was maybe about 5 years ago. Why don't we start there and then we'll go back to your history, your first political work,
sure.
Your first campaign work and all that.
Sure. So I am the president of the Consumer Health Alliance, and that is a national trade association of discount healthcare companies. And for those of your listeners who don't know what that is, these are non-insurance programs that make ancillary healthcare products and services more affordable. So they're membership programs that offer discounts on dental care, vision care, chiropractic care, podiatry, various ancillary healthcare services where you pay a monthly fee and you get a list of healthcare providers who will give you a discount. So these programs were generally unregulated because they're not insurance programs.
It's access to networks.
It's access to discounts. Exactly. It's
right.
A membership program.
So if I am, I'm a consumer and I don't, is it typically the individual purchases this product or is it by more?
It can be either. It can be, you can buy it, consumers can buy it directly from companies that offer it, or it's often offered as by employers to employees.
To their employees.
Associations to their membership, unions to their membership,
mm-hmm.
even offered through some state governments to state government workers.
Okay. So they get access to these networks of doctors and dentists, whatever it may be, podiatrists, whatever, and they get a discounted rate, which they know beforehand. You've published what it is.
Correct.
So that's the general concept.
General concept okay. is if you don't have dental insurance or vision insurance, this is a way to save money on that care.
Okay. Do you do health care insurance?
No. And although I would say that a lot of health insurance plans include discount benefits as part of the whole package.
Okay.
So a health insurance plan that, of course, covers doctors and hospitals and labs and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff won't typically include any routine
right.
dental care,
right.
but a lot of health insurance plans will add dental or vision discount benefits that
okay.
their subscribers can access.
Okay. So, for instance, I don't have dental insurance, and so I could purchase access to various dentists in my area.
When we're done, Jim, we'll sign you up. Absolutely.
So that's the general concept for dental,
absolutely.
Vision, all that. Okay.
You can pay, you know, as little as $6-7 a month, maybe a few bucks more for your whole family, and you'll get a list of dentists
and what they charge
in Hartford
or the discounts.
Yes, and your savings are typically 20-60% off of what
yep.
you would pay if you just walked in.
So your companies have already negotiated
it's
the rates.
It's pre-negotiated.
So you don't have to
rates,
do that.
Exactly.
Okay. And the dentist, for instance, would like it because they're getting access to more patients. They don't really need to negotiate these rates. If they're already charging these rates to other clients, they're happy to charge them to new
exactly
clients.
Right. It's frequently the same rate that they've negotiated to be paid by a dental insurance company. So mm-hmm. they are offering a reduced rate to get more business. Absolutely.
Okay.
Exactly right.
Okay. So I interrupted you. You were talking about dental, vision, and then you're touching on healthcare, and I think you were going to say something else.
I was just saying that the industry, these companies were generally not regulated until about 15 years ago when states started getting an interest. There were some kind of bad guys out there who started marketing these programs like insurance. Hmm. And the companies that formed the Consumer Health Alliance were the major players in the industry who said, hey, we need to
get engaged
yep. and educate policymakers.
Because you're not insurance. You're not taking
Because we're
risk.
Not insurance,
right.
and
you're
it's a very simple, low-cost product that had operated without any problem for many years because it was a good value and yep. offered a real benefit. But not really well known. So when some kind of bad actors came in and started in a pretty high profile way to charge a lot of money and to describe these programs as insurance, it got their attention, and there started to be some calls to ban this business. And we needed to jump in really quickly and explain what it is and why it's good and why we, as the companies that offer this, as well have an interest in making sure that the programs are consumer friendly and offer a lot of benefit.
And has that effort been successful? Has it paid off?
It has paid off. It required a lot of hard work, including by you in Connecticut, but you know, replicated in many, many states. I've visited more state capitals than I'd
like to. How many do you think?
I don't know. I
would
probably
guess 20.
20, around
yeah,
20.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Let's just say they're not all as nice as Hartford. So.
Well, Hartford's building has been rated at various times the nicest capital building. What do you have any state capitals that you remember as being that stand out in your mind for various reasons?
Well, I'm a frequent visitor to Austin, so that's...
Great city?
It's a great city, a great place for a capital.
And is that because you have member companies there, or you're working at the state capital?
Both.
Okay.
Both. We've been engaged in a number of issues in Texas. I unfortunately visited Lincoln, Nebraska twice, both times in the dead of winter. So I'll just tell folks, if you have business in Lincoln in the winter, make sure you arrange for a car to pick you up at the airport because there's no taxis anywhere.
To be
just a little tip.
Who are some of your, if you don't mind sharing, your member companies that make up the alliance?
Yeah, so our board member companies are Carrington International.
Carrington's based in Texas?
They're based outside of Dallas in Frisco, Texas.
Okay.
New Benefits, which is also based in Dallas.
Okay.
Coverdale, which is based in Chicago.
Okay.
And Dental Plans, which is based in Plantation, Florida.
Okay. And is dental and vision the primary services that...
Dental and vision are the most popular
okay.
benefits that that come with our members' plans because they are the most popular non-medical benefits that people want.
Right. Right. All right, let's back up. Where'd you grow up? Let's start with that.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And
went to high school
during
in Pittsburgh?
The 70s.
Okay.
When Pittsburgh was the city of champions.
Yes, it was.
So I grew up in Pittsburgh,
okay.
went to school at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Went to law school at Harvard.
Okay.
And then moved to D.C.
What was your first job in D.C. after law school?
My first job in D.C. was working for a public policy-oriented law firm.
Okay.
Which, through several mergers, is now K&L Gates. But that was a great experience
okay.
in working with a variety of different people on a variety of different subjects. And got me some exposure to Capitol Hill, which is the reason that I moved to D.C. in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And what type of work were you doing then?
I was doing anything from standard litigation, representing airlines on minor lawsuits brought by passengers, which proved to be quite entertaining.
Why is that?
Oh, just the nature of the cases. We had a case where a plane was parked on the tarmac in Boston at Logan for 3 hours in the middle of February in a blizzard, and a woman started doodling on her tray table, drawing pictures that showed a flight attendant pointing to one side saying, "This is an exit," pointing to the other side saying, "This is an exit," but then wrote, "But there's no way out." And nerves were apparently very frazzled, and the flight attendants got angry with her, and the pilots got angry with her, and you know, she eventually was arrested when the plane got to the airport and sued for false imprisonment. So that was one case. We had another case where a person got angry and threw a plate of food all over and somehow filed a lawsuit.
And how long did you spend at that law firm?
I was there for about 4 years.
Okay. And now, when you say public policy oriented, what is that? What does that mean? I mean, I can guess what it means, but...
It means the firm did a variety of governmental work, anything from straight-up lobbying.
Part of it was lobbying, and part of it was more helping with companies and their associations form public policy positions and interacting with the various government agencies.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I loved it because, first of all, I was a great firm with great folks who gave me a lot of good mentorship and exposure to lots of different aspects of legal work. Also, it confirmed the reason that I moved to DC, which was to work, you know, in and around government and set the stage for my next job.
Which was?
Which was working on the House Judiciary Committee.
And when did you start that? You remember what year?
1991.
1991, okay. And how many years did you spend there?
About four.
4 years, okay.
And through the 1994 midterm election, where the Republicans took control of the House after 42 years of Democratic control.
Yeah. So who was chairing the committee when you were working for it?
I worked for Jack Brooks,
okay,
who was a fantastic guy, just passed away not too long ago. He's had led the committee for just a few years, even though he'd been in Congress for many years, for about 40 years, I think, at that point.
So what was it like working for the committee?
It was the best job I've ever had.
Was it?
Yeah. For anybody who's interested in government and policy, it's the epicenter of the universe. So to be able to work on creating laws for our country on important issues and, you know, to make policy, it's just fantastic experience. Okay.
And how many lawyers were there on the Democratic side working?
So I worked for what we called the full committee, full committee staff.
Okay.
Then there were various subcommittees that had their own staff that had different chair people. So there was really me and a colleague on the full committee who shared responsibility for the five subcommittees.
Okay.
So I oversaw the Civil and Constitutional Rights Subcommittee, the Immigration Subcommittee, Courts, and also Patents and Trademarks.
Was there one particular area that you enjoyed the most or took up the most time that you remember?
There was a lot of issues coming out of civil and constitutional rights at that time, as well as immigration, always, even then. The biggest thing that I worked on, as well as my colleague, all of us did, you know, turned out to be the 1994 crime bill.
Okay.
So that was a massive piece of legislation that had a long and harrowing path to ultimate enactment.
Do you have to spend, for those, again, who don't work in Washington or on the Hill, do you have to spend a lot of that time negotiating, working with the Senate side?
On a bill like that, I mean, dozens and dozens of hours negotiating with the Senate.
Okay.
The House had its own crime bill. The Senate had its crime bill. They were vastly different. They needed to be reconciled. So there were many, many, overnight negotiations among staff and then lengthy negotiations among House and Senate conferees to hammer out a bill. And then even when a bill was hammered out, the initial bill actually failed in the House and had to go back to conference and be renegotiated before it ultimately passed at a vote that was probably about 5 a.m. Wow. If I remember the final vote in the House, and there were members of Congress who were strewn about the House chamber, asleep. There actually had been, I believe it was a New York Times story, but I can't recall specifically, but there had been a report, this of course pre-internet days, so there was a print report that the renegotiated bill failed in the House. And I remember then Congressman Schumer, who was the chairman of the House Crime Subcommittee, holding up this newspaper as the House was actually passing the bill. So the report was just wrong. But yeah, that was the singular thing that took a huge amount of my time during my years on the Hill.
And when you were having the conferences, how many different House members would be in those meetings?
There would be quite a few. I mean, there were a lot. And again, those were the days when members in some ways were freer to do the right thing. I remember a provision dealing with incarceration of folks without adequate evidence. And Henry Hyde, who was the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, who is a staunch conservative from Illinois, staunch Republican conservative, mm-hmm. listened to the, because I was sitting behind him, sitting behind my chairman, and Congressman Hyde was right next to him. And Congressman Hyde listened to the discussion about this provision and turned and asked me and his staff person a question about, is that really true that this would allow people to be jailed without this amount of proof? And we said yes. He said, well, that's not right. I'm not supporting that. And it was a provision that, it was a Republican provision.
Wow.
I don't think that would happen today.
No.
Because that wasn't reported back then. Mm-hmm. Today, everything is reported. Right. And, you know, if you're not on board 100%, then right. You're not part of the team.
Right. Can you think of any other members of the committee that people would recognize from today?
Oh, well.
Chuck Schumer, Henry Hyde.
The Senate Judiciary Chairman was Joe Biden.
On the Senate side.
On the Senate side.
Yep.
And, you know, he's still today talking about the Violence Against Women Act as one of his signature accomplishments, and that was part of the 1994 crime bill.
Okay.
Ted Kennedy was another Senate conferee and very active in on the particular immigration provisions that were part of that bill.
And so they'd come to these meetings and they would come
going personally
over
and
provisions.
We went through. We had conference meetings that lasted, you know, 10 hours.
Wow.
And we would just slog through it
section by section.
Right. Staff would have already met for days and nights and worked out what we could.
Yep. Yep.
But where there was disagreement among staff or where staff knew that their members had
a disagreement,
they were not, you know, staff can only go as far as their members are willing to go. And where there were disagreements, they had to be brought to a real conference committee. So that would be held in a big room with a big square layout. And there would be 20, 25 members of Congress who would go over various provisions and vote, and that's how things got resolved.
Wow, fascinating. That's and so when you left the Hill, what was next?
So I lost my job in the 1994 election.
Yep.
And I traveled around the world with my
now,
wife.
Did you lose your job, or did it just they obviously are no longer the majority, so staff gets let go. I mean, that's...
Well, the staff get... Yeah.
I mean, some of the staff get to stay.
Some do, but, you know, to the victor goes the spoils.
Right. So you're.
So I think it's maybe not appreciated how much of a difference it makes, and this is relevant, obviously, now, how much of a difference it makes who controls, which party controls. The difference between 218, which is a majority of one party, and 218 of the other party is not just one vote on the floor of the House. It controls all of the levers of the institution. So from a staffing perspective, as a good example, the staff on the minority side is maybe 25% of what it is on the majority side. In addition to, of course, the ability to completely set the agenda and the rules and the oversight of the administration and many, many other things. So,
right.
Yeah. So my wife and I had been planning on taking a long trip, or certainly seriously thinking about it. And so that just solidified it for me. So I could have stayed in and worked on the minority staff, but it was a good time to leave the country.
And so where'd you go?
So we traveled around the world for 6 months.
Wow.
Mostly through Asia and Africa.
Okay. You come back home, and then I
got back to D.C.
And
it was typical
resume.
D.C. summer. It was 9,000 degrees with 137% humidity. My wife will tell you that I sat in the house with the blinds drawn in my shorts for a couple of weeks trying to ignore the reality of a, you know, Republican-controlled Congress, a stifling D.C. summer, no job, and no longer, you know, seeing incredible sights around the world.
Right.
I called a friend of mine who I had worked with on the Hill, who was working in the Clinton Justice Department, finally, after weeks, and thought, okay, I better get started on something. And she said, oh, I think I may have a job for you. Come, let's meet. And so we met, and she talked about a position at what was then the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which was an arm of the Justice Department. I was reluctant because I had had oversight responsibility of the INS when I worked on the Hill, and I knew that it had a lot of problems, let's just say, as an agency in fulfilling its mission.
Can you touch on what type of problems in general?
The agency had a hugely important mission. At that time, it was responsible not only for providing immigration benefits like visas, green cards, citizenship, it was also performed all of the functions that ICE currently does in terms of enforcing the immigration laws inside the United States, detaining immigrants who needed to be detained, and deporting people who were judged to be removed from the U.S., as well as border functions that are done by the Border Patrol and at ports of entry, airports, and land seaports as well. So it was a massive, massive bureaucracy that had not gotten sufficient attention over the years in terms of ensuring that it was doing its job well. And so it just struggled systems-wise, kind of command and control, unified vision, record-keeping, just many, many aspects of government. It wasn't, it was struggling to perform.
And was immigration, I mean, today it's obviously, I mean, it's on the front page of the paper almost every day. Back then, I think it was still being.
It was still a big issue.
Yeah. Okay.
Big and small. Yeah. Big issues and small issues. The Clinton administration dramatically increased the size of the Border Patrol during those years, increased focus on criminal, really bad guys who, after serving their sentences, were to be deported. A real emphasis on citizenship applications and getting those done in a timely way to people who deserved, had earned it. So it was, all of those things were big issues back then and have never stopped.
So you took the job?
I did.
And how long did you work there?
I worked there for about 4.5 years. Wow. In a couple of different positions. I started as a counselor to the commissioner, Doris Meisner, who was a great person to work with and for, and a great leader for the organization, kind of providing, you know, policy and political advice. Mm-hmm. I was the liaison with the White House on immigration issues. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to run the Congressional Relations Office. So I was then back on the Hill from the executive branch side, dealing with various committees and congressional offices, whether it was on broad immigration policy issues or the thousands and thousands of casework inquiries that came through district offices to DC offices.
Thousands, really?
Thousands. Huh. Because the agency was, again, it was struggling.
Now, all those things that you mentioned, do you think, did you get credit for doing those things while you were, did the Clinton administration get recognized for that? I mean, all those things that you talked about?
So this would be like a typical day when I went up to the Hill for meetings. Okay, I would go up and I would meet with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and they would complain loudly and vociferously about how we were a bunch of jackbooted thugs who were tearing families apart and, you know, had no compassion and were incompetent at providing, you know, benefits, providing benefits that people deserved, providing, you know, any sort of due process or anything. My next meeting would be with the Republican leadership, Congress, you know, at that point, that the House was
in Republican control.
Yep. So I'd meet with the Republican chairman, who would complain loudly and vociferously that we were a bunch of pansies who were just giving out benefits willy-nilly to millions of people who didn't deserve it, and we had no controls and no enforcement capability. And, you know, we weren't doing our job. So I wouldn't say exactly that we got credit for a lot. It was more the opposite, that we were a punching bag for everybody.
An impossible position.
It was a challenging position.
And it's amazing that you still have, I mean, that's how many years ago? 25 years ago? 20 years
that's,
ago?
That's 20
plus years ago.
Yeah.
And the same issues are being debated today.
Yeah, exactly the same.
And even probably in a much more partisan, much more non-helpful manner.
Well, it's a challenging issue for elected officials. It's not so much challenging for the country. I think the country, and poll after poll after poll from that time till yesterday, will show vast majorities of the country wanting a comprehensive solution to immigration issues, recognizing that people who have been here for a long time, who haven't done anything wrong, who have contributed to their communities, shouldn't be deported, and that we should enforce immigration laws.
Decide how many people we want to have
right.
come here.
We should have a real, we should have borders that work and a system that works. And for some reason, our elected officials just are unable to listen to their constituents.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the whether it's the politics of it or whatever it is. Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Yes. Well, and it's unfortunate because there are millions of people whose lives are in limbo.
Right. And I've heard people who work on it just like say just what you just said, that if you actually had the people who work on this from both perspectives on a daily basis come together, they could quickly come to an agreement.
Yes.
On it.
It's there.
It's not that complicated.
It's not that complicated. The Senate did it a number of years ago.
Right.
They came up with a comprehensive bill that, in my view, would have passed on the floor of the House.
But they wouldn't call it.
They wouldn't bring it for a vote. So it's unfortunate. It's similar to lobbying, right? There are some lobbyists, and you may know some of them, Jim, who don't want a solution to the issues they've been hired to work on, because then they don't have anything to work on anymore.
But don't you think... Well, actually, we'll get to that in a minute. So let's finish your career track because we're getting on too many tangents. So four and a half, so that's two very interesting jobs on the Hill. And then what? What was next?
Then I moved to Los Angeles. And
smart
here we are.
Smart move. Out of the humidity, out of all that mess, to L.A., to Mayor Brown.
Yes.
Great firm. And you spent how many years there?
11.
And that's where I met you.
Yes.
Where you were doing this work and overseeing. So how did you get into... So you had these clients and they had these needs in the state and you had a political background. So you began to do this work where you oversaw their team of people in the various states.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of serendipity involved.
Right.
First in getting to L.A. because I had a pretty standard Washington, D.C. resume.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of concerns about...
And a lot of... Sorry to interrupt. Your whole network was probably D.C.-based.
Yes.
And you
yes.
probably had a number of opportunities you could have pursued in D.C.
Yes. But it was not at all clear that my resume transferred outside of D.C. But I was fortunate to join what was then a small government practice group at the L.A. office of Mayor Brown and continue to do the type of work that I was interested in, although not as much federally focused, but,
more
you know,
state focused.
Those of us who, you know, people ask me what I do, and I say I understand government, so I understand how government works, and just as someone would hire a trial attorney to help them through the trial process because it's a mystery, people would hire me to help them through a government process because
right.
it's a mystery. So right. I'm an expertise in the process. The substance, you know, I can figure out, right? But it's the process advice that is really valuable. So
right.
we had a team at Mayor Brown of people who had worked in government who understood how government works and were helping clients through those processes. So just at the time that I joined the firm, there had been a discount healthcare firm that was trying to get a bill passed in California to clarify the status of discount plans in California. And that effort didn't succeed. But out of that, that company had an inkling of an interest in forming a trade association. So I quickly became involved in that, doing a survey of state laws regarding these types of programs, and then helped to form the association. And then very quickly, we were fighting battles simultaneously in a dozen states across the country.
And then you would oversee that the various lobbyists and that whole process in those states on behalf of the client.
Right. And we would handle them differently. We would try to just lobby ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
you could come testify. You could.
I've testified in a number of state legislatures.
Yeah.
But it becomes very obvious when they're not particularly interested in hearing from the Los Angeles lawyer.
Right.
And that we need to get some ground help.
Well, and sometimes things are a quick fix, and it's
true.
You testify at a public hearing, you have a couple of meetings, there's no opposition, and things seem to happen. In other states, it's more like you just described. It's trench warfare, and it's a long slog and a
right.
big battle. But as you were saying, you understand how elected officials think, and so although the process may be different on a federal versus a state level, the thinking process is very much the same.
Right.
And interacting with them is the same in the sense of what's important to them and what they listen to and what they care about. How did you find the difference between the state and the federal?
I liked it. I liked it because it is much easier to access in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
In D.C., there's layers upon layers, both inside an agency or a congressional committee, as well as outside of it. Whereas, you know, at state level, it's sometimes just simpler.
Yeah. You can grab somebody in the hallway.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's right. And now you're here on your own.
Yes.
We were joking before we started this podcast about how things in Connecticut quickly, I think we only had 1 or 2 years, maybe only one. And you were indicating that if it gets dragged on, if a lawyer or a lobbyist has a client with a problem, that you keep the client. If the problem goes away, you lose the client. And so you have to make sure that people are trying to actually get the problem solved, which is where you come in.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, again, because many clients, no matter what level of business sophistication they have, the government process is just a mystery. They don't know whether the issue could have been resolved and whether their lobbyist made every effort to resolve the issue.
And there's really no way to know.
No.
There really isn't. Which is why it's critical to hire the right people.
Right.
Which is where you come in again.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
and so you,
I don't know, again, if I'm hiring a state lobbyist, it's because I either don't know or can't access the inner workings of that state legislature. But
because you're trying to keep costs down for the clients. For the client.
Well, I'm trying to get a result for the client.
Right.
So,
but it's probably always easier to hire someone, but it's more expensive.
Right.
So to help keep costs down, you would try to do it yourself if you could.
Right.
Which you've I mean, I know you've had a lot of success doing that in a number of states.
Yes.
So how do you like LA?
Well, so for many years, my answer uncomfortably would be, I love the weather. It was uncomfortable because that sounds like a typical LA, you know, vapid, shallow response. But over time, I've learned that, in fact, it's the real response because the weather here affects everything. It is so much a part of the quality of life. So being able to be outside year round.
Yes.
It permeates all aspects of life.
Alan, this has been great. It was great to see you.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's been good to reconnect.
Yes, you seem like you're doing very well. And very.
As do you.
Well, you have a very nice, I'm very jealous of your lifestyle out here. So maybe we'll have to relocate the podcast. So
you're welcome. We'd love to have you.
All right, Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, there it is. I hope you enjoyed it. It was great to sit down with Alan. Love LA. Now, if you like our podcast and want to help spread the word, the best thing you can do, and it's easy, is to subscribe to our podcast and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you listen. If you want additional insights about our guests, upcoming shows, and more, sign up for Monday Morning Coffee with The Lobbying Show at our website, thelobbyingshow.com. If you're not already, be sure to follow us on Twitter at The Lobbying Show. You can also find us on Facebook and on Instagram. Now go petition your government. You might as well. It's yours.